just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you understand. We all need somebody to lean.
All right, guys, let's take our seats and get started. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Zach. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our silent two-minute meditation. So if you could please turn off all cell phones or any noise-making devices that are going to distract the people around you, we really appreciate it. So take a moment to get comfortable in your seat, get situated, and we're going to take this time to get connected with God and just ask Him to help you focus on this step study tonight. So when we're ready, we're going to shut off the lights. If you guys want to join me in the saying the fog light prayer, the cards are in the seat in front of you. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light for those who are lost, sick, and dying. Can find your love through me. Amen. From there is a solution from the Big Book. The tremendous fact for every one of us is we've discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those of us who suffer from alcoholism. And I've asked a friend, Alex, to read Spiritual Appendix 2 from the book, Spiritual Experience. Our aim in going through the steps and doing the program is to attain a spiritual experience, and Appendix 2 explains what that is, and I think it's important we all know what that looks like.
I'm Alex, and I'm an alcoholic. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problem in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
We'd also like to ask if you could please refrain from disturbing others by talking and constantly getting up and down during the meeting. Unless you have to go to the bathroom. This is also a tech-free meeting, so if you could set your phones to airplane mode or just turn them off, we'd really appreciate it. If you guys please don't text during the meeting, and thank you for those of you who don't. And with that being said, I'd like to introduce Russell. He's been speaking for us for the last 9 weeks, and he's fantastic. So welcome, Russell.
Good evening. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I since January 25th, 1981, so I'm grateful to God for that, and I want to share a few things with you all. It's good to be at an AA meeting. It's always good for me to be. It's a privilege to be able to share at an AA meeting. I always like being around other alcoholics. Truth of the matter is, I like being around. You don't even have to have a chip in your pocket for me to be friendly with you. I belong to other fellowships. I belong 15 years sober. I joined a church, and I go to Bible study and all that stuff. And wherever I am, I just love being with the people who are focused on developing a relationship with God. That's where it's at for me, and you'll probably sense that during my conversation here. In the big book, I was actually listening to this spiritual experience. Of course, I've heard it many times before, which was read, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, the difference, and all that sort of stuff, and how they talk about, It says, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what are called by psychologist William James the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. And that was to explain the statement that went before that. Many readers got the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. It's not our intention to create such an impression. Many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feelings and outlooks. And, of course, I'm going to talk about my experience, because that's the one I'm most familiar with. Now, after being sober for, it'll be 34 years this month, obviously I've worked, I've been to thousands of AA meetings, I've sponsored hundreds of men, I've watched hundreds and thousands of people get sober and not get sober. And so not only do I have my own personal experience, I've watched things happen. And that's what I'm going to try to share with you, my personal experiences in this deal. And the interesting thing is I happen to be one of those guys. I don't talk about it that much, but I happen to be one of those people. And by the way, I know when some of the I know some of you guys have been to the other meetings I did here where I talked about that little story when my sponsor asked me, why do you say the things you say and do the things you do? And I said, that's just my personality. And he said, Russell, it's your personality that's killing you. Carl Menninger wrote a book in the 1930s called Man Against Himself. He said, alcoholics are people who are out to destroy themselves. And so this concept that there's got to be some sort of psychic change, some personality change, however that's done, is a bedrock, one of the things that I believe happens as you focus on God. That's what changes your personality. That's what happened to me. But I happen to be one of these people. I don't take exception with this, but I'm just going to frame it a little bit differently. I happen to be one of these people who had a sudden religious experience. No particular reason why, except I drank myself into it, I suppose, and on a particular day, at a particular time in January, I asked God's help and something happened. I'm not going to explain to you what happened because I'm not even sure I can explain what happened, but something phenomenal happened to me. I had a spiritual God consciousness experience, and it was real. It was as real as you could possibly imagine. And in any event, and even though I had that experience, and I believe it evoked a certain change in me, the truth of the matter is, the absolute truth of the matter is, notwithstanding that sudden religious experience that I had early on in January of 1981, the personality change that's happened to me in the last 34 years, because you're going to have to trust me on this, at 66 years of age, after 34 years of sobriety, sitting here before you, I ain't the same guy who walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 3 months sober. You all understand that? I mean, if you had met me, you know, how many people here have less than 6 months? Okay, listen. When I had less than 6 months, you know what I was like? I was just like anybody with less than 6 months. You know, whenever I was going crazy or suffering from any problem, or just confused in Alcoholics Anonymous, which generally happens during the first 20 years or so, you know, I could have 3 months, I could have 3 years, I could have 10 years, I could have 15 years, it didn't matter. When I walked up to somebody who had 30 or 40 years and explained to them the horrendous problems that were going on in my life and what was going on in my brain and how confusing it was and trying to find some sort of answer, invariably, many times, that person would say to me, you know, how much time do you have? And I'd say, I have 6 months. And they'd say, you're exactly where you're supposed to be. In other words, there's an old saying in AA, time, things I must earn. Whether you have a sudden religious experience or not, the truth of the matter is that the real personality change happens without any question over a period of time as you're working these things, going to meetings, talking to sponsors, and doing what you need to do while you're dealing with the horse shit. You understand? I mean, you got to be dealing with that crap. You got to be dealing. Listen, you got to be in the real. You need a live alcoholic with that crazy alcoholic brain out there in the real world. It doesn't work on. It doesn't work if you're locked in a closet. You got to be out there with the crazies. You got to out. You could be out there losing jobs. You got to be out there getting cancer. You got to be out there with people dying. You got to be out there with the. You got to be out there on US 1. You got to be out there with guys bouncing checks on you. I mean, whatever your problem is that your experience, which by the way is common to all mankind, there's not a person in here. Whatever problem you're experiencing, that isn't experienced at a problem that hasn't been experienced to probably 100,000 people on this particular day at that particular time, and you've probably experienced the same problem before in your life when you were drinking and when you're not drinking, and you want to know something? 10 years from now, you're going to experience that same problem again. You're going to experience the same problems. There ain't too many original problems. There ain't too many original thoughts or feelings or anything going on in here. You know something? 99% of you guys, when you experience a problem in your life, you're going to say something like this: why is this happening to me again? It's not going to be, well, boy, that's a brand new problem, or I've never felt this before. You know, the only frustration you're going to have is, when is this going to stop? I mean, your problem is not that it's a new problem. Your problem is how come I always do the same thing over and over again? It's almost like the drinking. How come I always find myself in this situation with this problem and this deal? And so the truth of the matter is the profound personality change that's described in many parts of the book, but they use different language. You got to look past the language. They use different language. The profound personality change that's described happens over a period of time, happens through the grace of God, through your relationship with God, which is why, by the way, if you notice, God's kind of prominent in there. Have you ever heard him say something like, there is one who has all power, that one is God, may you find him now? They were like serious about that. There's one who has all power, that one is God. You ever hear something like this? No, we can't manage our own lives. You can't manage your way out of this. No human power can help you. Only God could and would if he was sought. I mean, like, what do you think they're talking about? You ever hear them say, see to it your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass in your life? You ever hear things like that where they talk about the God thing and all that sort of stuff? God. You ever notice that in the steps they talk about turning your will and your life utterly over to him, your will and your life over to him? And then when you finally work all this crap, you finally get to 11 and they say, okay, now that you got it utterly over to him, now what you got to do is try to get even more closer to him. You ever see that stuff? How about when it says having made where they say you got to quit playing? It says selfishness, self-centeredness. That's the root of the problem. 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on the toes of others. They retaliate, seemingly out of provocation. But we ultimately learn that we've made decisions based upon self, based upon self. It's like impossible to get rid of me. 3,000 years ago, King Solomon, Ecclesiastes, said, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It's all about vanity. It's all about me. At the best, I can't get involved. You know, I was driving today. Man, I'll tell you, it's gotten a hell of a lot better. But I still can't get rid of me. My whole deal is just trying to get rid of me. I mean, no matter how much I want to love God and no matter how much I want to focus on God, you know, the truth is, there's something that draws me to me all the time. You know, it's subtle. You know, in the big book, when it says, above all, it says, we must get rid of this selfishness. Listen, we must or it kills us. And then it says, God makes that possible. And then right after that, it says something very interesting. It says, first things first. First of all, number one thing first, we've got to quit playing God. And most of us don't even know until we get here and listen to a lot of people and hang out what it means to even play God, because we don't think we're playing God. We're not playing God. I just want things to go my way. I just look at the world and I notice when everything's unfair, when people aren't doing what they're supposed to do, when things aren't operating the way they're supposed to do. I know how you're supposed to act. I know when you're doing wrong. I know when everybody. It's as natural to me. My thinking is as natural to me as being right-handed. I don't even have to think about thinking the way I think. I see some guy walking in a bar in the back of the room with a good-looking blonde, and I turn to my friend and I said, look at that asshole. You know what I mean? And I know he's a jerk. I immediately don't like him. I know there's something. I mean, I judge things, think of the way things should be. I read people's minds, you know? You know, like the two psychiatrists, you know, one says hi, the other one says, I wonder what he meant by that, you know, and it's, I'm always reading their minds and figuring out things and figuring out what's going to happen, how it's going to happen. And they say, first of all, we got plain God, and I don't know what they're talking about by plain God. This is just the way I think. I just can't get rid of that vanity. You know, even when I finally say, well, thank God it's not as bad as it used to be. You know, I'm a guy who is, even though I was making good money, you know what I mean, in my profession, I was always broke. You know, I mean, I was always spending money I didn't have, buying things I didn't need to impress people I didn't like, you know. And thank God I got that, you know, fairly much under control. It's gotten better and better as the personality changes happened, okay? But I would never say, man, thank God I got rid of that vanity stuff. It's always hounding me. You know, I was thinking today as I was driving, because I was thinking about not necessarily, I was just thinking about what I'm talking about today. And I decided I was going to go in and get my car washed. Anybody ever get a car? Anybody who has a car ever get a car washed? You ever do that? So, I mean, I got a nice car out there. You can see it. It's a Mercedes, a nice car. So I was thinking of pulling in, and it was a little dirty. I figured I'd pull in and get a car washed. They cost about, you know, where I get it washed, it costs about $8-9, you know? And to get it washed, and I started thinking, you ever think about this? Why am I getting my car washed? You ever think about that? Why do people make millions and millions of dollars over the years, billions of dollars, running car washes? Really, why do people wash their cars? Now, you might be thinking, well, that's a stupid question, huh? So that's, I mean, really, why should I care whether my car is dirty on the outside? Let's say, I mean, I'll give you on the outside. I mean, I should care whether it runs. I should care whether it's mechanically sound. You know, God knows the kind of person who's in that car. I know the kind of person that's in that car. Why am I getting my car washed? Why do I have that instinct, that compulsion? I got to get this car washed. This car looks crappy. I got to get it washed. Isn't a part of it, if not a major part of it, is I want people to think about me a certain way. Doesn't it have something to do with that? Doesn't it have something to do with, hey, how about this? It's all about the vanity, isn't it? It's all about me. That compulsion to get my car washed is the thing that compels me to do everything, to get a new suit, to get a new blouse, you know, to lose whatever. It's all about me. It's a compulsion to spend money on, and, you know, it wasn't necessary to get, my car wasn't that bad. You know, I was just feeling, well, it'll make me feel a little bit better if I can look good on the outside of my car, you know? Now, you may think I'm taking this too far, but I don't think so, because it shows me how this concept of me, and what people think about me, no matter how long I'm in this program, still works on me in subtle ways, having me spend money on stuff that really isn't necessary at all. So I'm an alcoholic. You know, in the big book it says, so then it says after the, we got to quit playing God, it says, once we take this position, sincerely, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful, he gives us everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. He gives us everything we need. All we have to do is stay close to him and perform his work well. It says we lose concerns for our little plans and designs. We start gaining concerns for others. And then it talks about we lose fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. It says we get this God consciousness, and that evokes a personality change. And in the sixth step, which we already went through, remember what it says in the sixth step? As you talk about this psychic change, this personality change in the sixth step, it says the thing that separates the men from the boys, the childlike personality, let's call it just for lack of any more specific language, let's call it like a childlike personality. You know, I mean, like the temper tantrums, the feeling sorry for yourself, the angry, you know, all the stuff that we do. From going from a childlike personality to a mature and adult personality, the thing that separates the men from the boys, what does it say? It says It says, as we change our ideas, where we want to become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character that keep us from Him. It says in describing the men instead of the boys, it says it's those people who try repeatedly to grow in the image and likeness of their Creator. That's how the 12 and 12 describes the personality change. The personality change we're interested in. You know, when my sponsor said, when I said, that's just my personality, and he said, your personality is going to kill me. It's going to kill you. It's trying to kill you. That's what Carl Menninger said. An alcoholic is out to destroy yourself. Your personality unchanged from the way you were, it doesn't matter if you stop drinking. There's millions of alcoholics that stop drinking. They end up committing suicide or killing themselves or doing something to self-destruction. It happens every day of the week. Every day of the week, there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous doing stupid, crazy things, getting themselves in trouble, sober, without the booze. The alcohol is but a symptom of our disease. We got a lot of symptoms. We go out and buy shit that we don't even need and overspend and find ourselves in financial difficulties just because we want to look good or feel secure because we don't feel secure. Look, we just get ourselves in so many jams through compulsive moves and obsessive moves without even knowing what we're doing because we are driven. It says ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are the guiding forces, the driving forces of these men, are changed and they become motivated by whole different ideas, thoughts, and attitudes, which are more healthy. So, you know, just because we're not drinking doesn't mean we're not crazy. I mean, this ain't exactly Well People's Anonymous, you know? And you'll find, I found, and alcohol's not only alcohol's the best substance. It worked best on alcoholism. You know, there's nothing that worked best on alcoholism than alcohol. And alcohol works fast on alcohol. But, you know, listen, guys, you know, girls work on alcoholism, too. Did you know that? Girls work on alcoholism. That's the next, you know, I mean, how many guys have I sponsored? Like, they're sitting in the back of the room, and at a meeting, he hits me, he says, look at that gal in the front row. Look at that one. Look at that. I mean, that's another addiction guys have. Girls have the same, you know, girls, romance. That's why in the sixth step it says money, power, and romance. Romance works on alcoholism, too, right? I mean, hey, listen. When I used to walk in a bar with a good-looking gal, you know what I mean, and all eyes were looking at me, man, I felt like I had three drinks. I felt like I was high. When I was driving a brand-new Camaro, you know, that just came off the thing, and I had the first one in Miami, and I'm driving with the window down with a cigarette and the sunglasses. I was so cool. I was like frosty, you know what I mean? I felt it was like being drunk. I was drunk with me, you know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of stuff. When I got the raise, when I got the pat, when I got the diploma, there's a lot of crap that we use to grab in our lives and run after. The worldly clamors, the fudge that Bill Wilson talked about, that we run after, that we need and think we have to have in order to feel okay because we still feel so crappy without it. As a matter of fact, most of the discussion meetings that you go to where people are whining and crying and sucking their thumbs, they're generally talking about chasing after that stuff or why don't they have stuff or what's going to happen with that stuff or what's going to happen if they lose that stuff. That's the deal. The booze goes away, but all the other symptoms and all the other drugs we use, they don't go away, and our desire to have them don't go away. And I'll tell you, it took me 15, I came in when I was 31. It took me 31 years and a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings and finally getting to the end of myself to finally figure out that I might have a problem with alcohol. How many years, and that's because I was crushed because alcohol will crush you. I mean, they'll arrest you for, you know, driving while under the influence. They don't arrest you for driving while lusting or driving while feeling sorry for yourself. You can go for years feeling sorry for yourself and not realize you got a problem. You know why they marriages can break up, all sorts of things can break up, and it's because you're a self-pityaholic, and you may not realize that until you're 20 years sober or 5 years sober. I mean, how many years do you have to go through to realize these other things and come to grips with them? And then when you finally realize it, how do you get out of it? How do you get that new personality? And the personality they're talking about that you're growing into, that other personality, because when somebody says you got to get rid of your friend, well, what kind of personality? It says it's the personality of it's the image and likeness of your Creator. It's that perfect personality. It's a different personality. Now, I was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is actually all leading up to something, but in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a line. If anybody ever seen this line, alcoholism, it was like alcohol was like the rapacious creditor. They call it the rapacious creditor. Now, I looked up the word. You know what rapacious means? Rapacious is like, it's, believe me, it's an evil deal. It's like the never satisfying, greedy, ferocious creditor. It's like, I'm not talking about the phone call you get, you know, once a week, you know, the automatic phone call saying, call this number. I'm not talking about the mail you get that you rip up and you throw away from Visa or something like that. I'm talking about the phone call every 3 hours. I'm talking about the guy that comes to your door with a baseball bat and says, we need $1,000 by tomorrow or we're breaking your kneecaps. I'm talking about the rapacious creditor. I'm talking about the guy, you know, I want it in an hour or else I'm evicting you from your house. That's what alcohol is. And listen, I paid everything to alcoholism. I paid it all. You know, it wanted my wife. I paid my wife. I paid it. I got rid of that wife. She said, you come home drunk more time or I'm leaving you. I came home drunk. That was the end of her. I paid. They wanted me to pay my wife. I paid my a sweet gal, a nice girl, a decent girl. I got rid of that marriage. You know, it wanted my 5-year-old son. I got rid of him. Alcohol demanded my 5-year-old son that I give up my 5-year-old son. I gave him up in a heartbeat. There wasn't even a question. It was my house. It was a really simple choice. My house, my beautiful house, my wife, and my son, or the bottle. You know how fast my decision was? Like 2 seconds. There was never even a decision. I knew what I was going to do. And as I was doing it, as I was walking away from those deals, I'm saying to myself, thank God I'm finally free. Free to fuck around, free to do what I want to do, free to go to the bars, never realizing I was never not free. They talk about the new freedom. They say until we realize that we have to stop playing God, that's the archway of freedom. We don't realize the slavery we're involved in, the bondage we're involved in. We're doing things thinking we're doing things because it's our free will, and the truth of the matter is I was never free not to go to the bar. I was never free not to leave the wife and kids. I was never free not to do what I did and make the decisions I made. I was making selfish, self-centered decisions, hurting people, and quite frankly, setting myself up to be hurt without even knowing it, thinking they were the best decisions I could make for me at my time, and I was making this, and I had no power to make the opposite decision. You know, I told the guy today, I went to a meeting today at 12 o'clock. It was a wonderful meeting because the guy picked up a white chip. And it was one of these guys that picked up a white chip. It was like a first time, and you know, he really needed help, and he was humble, you know, if you can believe that, an alcoholic who was humble, and he picked up a white chip. And I told him something. I went up and I told him something that was told to me when I first came in, you know, whether he understood it or not, but I'll tell you, when it was told to me, it was a remarkable thing. My sponsor said to me, when my first sponsor said, Russell, you never have to drink anymore if you don't want to. You know, nobody had ever said that to me. I'd had people ask me, why do I drink the way I drink? I had people say, why don't you stop drinking? I had people say, you know, I had people hound me about my drinking or don't you know you're killing yourself? I don't remember anybody saying to me, you never have to drink anymore if you don't want to. Because I thought at 31 years old that I had to drink. I couldn't envision a life without drinking. I don't know. I mean, y'all are alcoholics. I don't know whether you thought like I thought. I couldn't imagine, before I came in here, I couldn't imagine a life without drinking. How could you not drink? How could I not drink? I couldn't imagine. Not, I mean, because when you're powerless over alcohol, you know, when I came in here, I looked the guy in the eye and I said, I'll tell you what I said. I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. Hey, how many people couldn't stop drinking? I mean, if you could have stopped drinking, you don't belong. I'm going to tell you something. I'm not trying to chase you out, but you really don't belong here because you don't suffer from the disease of alcoholism. But I'm one of these guys that I'm powerless over alcohol. I couldn't stop. A was the last place I wanted to be. I couldn't stop drinking. So my sponsor looks at me. Now explain this to me. I could not stop drinking. I was powerless over alcohol. He looks at me and he says this. The same thing I said to this guy because I know it was the truth. You never have to drink anymore if you don't want to. Now how could both things be true? How could you be powerless over alcohol and not being able to stop drinking and all of a sudden you pick up a white chip and some guy looks and he says, you never have to drink anymore if you don't want to. And by the way, you guys know that's true. How could both things be true? How could you be powerless over alcohol and not be able to stop drinking so powerless that you got to come here, and then the next day somebody say to you, you never have to drink anymore. You have now been given the power to choose. You ever think about that? Where did you get the power to choose? I mean, you tried for weeks, months, and years to stop drinking. You couldn't do it. How come you have the power to choose? That ain't your power. You know it's not your power. You didn't walk in here with that power. You didn't have that power for years. That power came from somewhere. Where did it come from? And that's what we're talking about. That's the power to give you the ability, the freedom, to have the freedom to choose. That's the power that gives you the freedom to decide not to spend money you don't have to spend. That's the power that gives you the freedom to not to get the relationships you don't have to get into. That's the power that gives you the freedom to not talk or not talk back or not say something that you're dying. That gives you that same power, can do a lot of things in your life. And I gave that alcoholism my wife. I gave him my kid. I gave him my house. I gave it everything. I paid everything. I paid it all. I paid my self-respect. It wanted my self-respect, I just handed it to me. It wanted all my money, I gave it all my money. I charged up all the credit card. I gave that alcoholism all my money. Finally, it wanted my self-esteem. It wanted my soul. I said, here's my soul. I gave it my soul. I gave it everything. I had nothing. I was morally, spiritually, financially bankrupt. At 31 years old, I was dead. I was dead. I couldn't envision living. I couldn't envision dying. I was dead. I was at the end of me. And I don't know how to explain what it feels like to be at the end of you. I can't go up to the Kiwanis Club and say I was at the end of me and expect them to understand. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there are some people, not everybody, that understands what it's like to come to the end of yourself. You don't come to the end of yourself because you read something in a book. You don't come to the end of yourself because of knowledge or because somebody says something to you. You come to the end of yourself by coming to the end of yourself. When they talk in the seventh step about how we get a new perspective, it talks about 100 forms of humiliation and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. It says that's how we have these perceptions and these changes and these, we get rid of these old ideas. We learn the value of suffering. Whether we want to believe it or not, most of us, if not all of us, are sitting in an AA meeting, which we now believe is the greatest thing that ever happened to us, sitting in an AA meeting as a result of disaster, as a result of humiliation. I have yet to meet anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who said, I inherited $1 million. I had this good-looking girlfriend. I had this fast car. Everything was working great for me. And I decided, you know, this might be a good time to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, most people don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous riding the crest. You know what I mean? It's like, this is the end of my life. You know, they come here out of humiliation. I don't know much about humility, which they say, and this is important, which they say, it's even more important in the sixth and seventh step, which we've done already, says it's even more important. This is such a vital and essential element, such an essential element. And it's important to develop even more. Can you imagine that? Even more humility than walking up in front of a group of people and picking up a white chip? You mean even more humility than getting crushed? I mean, I came to the end of myself. The end of myself. I got down on my knees. I said, God, help me. I mean, I don't remember ever in my life prior to that time, seriously or sincerely. I remember the bargaining crap, if you help me get me out of this. But I don't remember any time in my life when I got down on my knees. I'm not talking about driving the car saying, God, if you get me out of this, I'm talking about getting down on my knees and saying, Lord, come into my life and help me. You know, I remember saying, man, if I had my girlfriend back, I'd be okay. If I had money back, I'd be okay. If I had a car back, I'd be okay. I never remember not even thinking about that stuff and just getting and being at the end of myself. Nothing was ever going to make it right. No girl, no money, no car, no nothing. Nothing. My life was over. You know, what does it say? We he'll know loneliness as few people do. He'll be at the jumping off place. When you're at the jumping off place, there ain't no girl that's going to fix it. I know we have this delusion that we're going to find, you know, if I could only find her, You know, I fix it. You know, the guy, if I could only find him, if I only had it, if I only had new God. When you're at the jumping off place, there ain't nobody nowhere that can fix that deal. And if you've ever been to the jumping off place, you know what I'm talking about. The only thing you can do at the jumping off place is get down on your knees and say, God, help me. And I'll tell you how you get there. You get there by drinking. I mean, I don't know how you get there. I'll tell you what, that's how I got there. I got there by drinking. You know, I mean, you really have to drink in order to get here. By the way, once you're here, the rule number two is you're supposed to stop. But, I mean, you really have to drink in order to get here. And so I get down on my knees, and whatever that thing is, that crushing, what does it say? A thousand forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, self-sufficiently, self-centeredness, self-sufficiency. What does the big book say we need? It says we need God-centeredness. We need to be God-centered, not self-centered, God-centered. And I'm so self-centered. That's my disease. I'm so self-centered. It's all about me, I, me. So self-centered. 3,000 years ago, Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity. Also, I'm so self-centered. Thinking about myself. And it took all the alcohol in the world. I had to drink my last drink. You can't rob an alcohol of its desperation to get to the point where I came to the end of myself, where I was put down on my knees, and I said, God, help me. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I got the humility to walk in here, walk up in front of a whole group of people and say, I need help, and pick up a white chip. It's a humbling experience. There's only one problem. I suffer from something called alcoholism. Now, you can call it a disease. I don't mind calling it a disease. I like calling it a disease. It's very helpful for new people. It's helpful for me. And I believe it is a disease. I think last week or the week after, James was telling me about it, I said, you know what the disease is? I said, you're the disease. Well, I know that's a little strong. I have a tendency to say strong things, you know, try to get people pissed off so they'll remember it. But in a sense, I believe that. I mean, I am so imbued with this disease. You know, it's sort of nice as alcoholics to be able to say, well, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. God forbid I should hurt your feelings, but let me tell you something. It's really nice to say, you know, I'm really a nice person. You know, Russell Spatz is really a good, decent, virtuous person. But I've got this disease that makes me evil and do terrible things to people. The only problem is the longer I live with myself, you know, I stop giving up the bullshit. You know, I stop making believe. I know I want to believe. I want to believe all sorts of things, you know. It says one of the natures of this disease, when you're selfish and self-centered, it says we suffer from, what does it say? We suffer from 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. You know, I'm done with self-delusion. You know something? I don't really need to say to myself, I'm really basically a good person that just suffers from a disease. I think it's a good thing. I think in a sense it's right. It's even biblical. It says we're not good. We're not bad people trying to get better. We're sick people trying to get well. I think that's good. I mean, Jesus used that. He said, I'm here for the sick people. Physicians, you know, well people. I mean, I understand that. But you want some? It makes just as much sense to me to say, you know, based upon my own self, without God, I'm just an evil guy. Nah, I'm not Adolf Hitler. I'm somewhere between Mother Teresa and Adolf Hitler. You know, it's not, I mean, I'm somewhere between there, but I'm not necessarily a saint. Okay, I mean, left to my own devices, I still do bad things to people, and I'm very much capable. In other words, I'm not so sensitive anymore, where I have to think of myself as a really, really good, decent person. As a matter of fact, for somebody like me, I got to tell you something. It actually helps me a little bit better to sort of think of myself as a real bad actor, unless I can get God in my life. You know why? Because if I think of myself as a real bad actor and somebody who can really hurt people, unless I stay close to God, it somehow, I got to be honest with you, it motivates me more to get closer to Him and grow in likeness of His image. You understand what I don't know if you understand. Hey, whatever you got to go to get where you got to go. You know what I mean? So I don't care whether you want to call it a sickness or whatever it is, but all I know is I got it. I've got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I got the brain of a chronic alcoholic. You know, I don't know where the good part of the brain is or the bad part of the brain is. I think it's like all over the brain. You know what I mean? It's like, what did Dr. What's his name? Not Silkworth. The other, what? No, the other doctor. The psychologist, the guy who helped Roland Hazard. Carl Jung. He says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never, you know, this is a guy who treated sick people, you know, with psychiatry. One of the greatest guys in the world. He says, I can cure sick people. But you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never been able to help anybody like that. You're just like too diseased. You know what I mean? You're like too sick. So, you know, whatever it is, it's a very serious disease. It's a very serious deal. And I came to the end of myself and I got down on my knees. Now, here's the problem. This disease is let me tell you something. I gave it everything. You know, after I gave alcoholism everything I owned, everything I had, and even my soul, myself, you know what it said? It said, I want more. It wanted more. You know, I had no more, I had nothing else to give the disease of alcoholism. I was bankrupt. There was nothing else I could have given the disease except kill myself. That's when I got down on my knees. That's where I asked God's help. That's when I got humble. That's when I picked up the white chip. That's when I said, will you sponsor me? That's when, for about a week or two, I actually listened to my sponsor. You know, I think I listened to my sponsor for about a week. I think I bought into what he said for a week. I think I went to meetings. And then, you know how this disease is. It's all about self and being self-centered and being arrogant and being defiant. That's the chief. You know, we walk in here unemployable. 3 weeks later, we're underpaid. You know, nobody will ever give us a job. We're not worth anything. Somebody gives us a job and says, they're screwing me. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, that's, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm telling my sponsor, I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursdays. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I'm telling them all these rules. I don't think I have to go on Thursdays. He says, sure, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. You know? I mean, it doesn't take long for that stuff to come back, that craziness to come back. So here's the question. It's one thing when you get crushed. It's one thing when you come to the end of yourself with the alcoholism. It's one thing when you get down on your knees and you say, God help me. You get to the point where everybody in this room, I would assume everybody in this room, got to a low point in their lives with alcoholism and crawled into AA and actually picked up a white chip and for like 5 seconds, 10 seconds, maybe a week, actually listened to somebody. But what do you do after you got a week or two or three or 10 or 6 months or 3 years sobriety? What do you do after you get your sobriety and you got, what do you do when you got 34 years? What do you do when you got 20 years? What do you got to do when you got 15 years and you got the job and you got the money and you got the car and you got the guy and you got the girl or you got the thing or you got whatever it is you got, the worldly stuff, the stuff that you were chasing after, you're still chasing after, and you're out there in the world and you're a year or two or three or five or six sober and they're patting you on the back and they're saying, anybody want to pick up? Yeah, and all that stuff. And all of a sudden, how do you get back to the humility you had when you walked into Alcoholics Anonymous? How do you get away from, you know, the selfishness and the self-centeredness? And the truth of the matter is for me, I mean, there's a whole lot of things. I got to do a whole lot of things. I got to come to meetings. I got to sponsor people. I got to serve people. I got to do the steps. You know something? I got to come to meetings. How do you continue to be God-centered and focused on God and grateful to God? You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says right here, in Alcoholics, the story on Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, there's a story in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. Alcoholics Anonymous number 3 was Bill Dodson. He's the guy, the man on the bed. Has anybody ever seen the portrait of the man on the bed? There was Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, and they're talking to this guy on the bed. He's in like a T-shirt, and Bill Wilson has the Bible open. You know, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Between 1935 and 1939, their path was to read the Bible. They didn't have a big book. So if you want to really thoroughly follow their path, you can read the Bible. That's what they did. I mean, you're entitled to your own opinion about religion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Okay, as a matter of fact, as far as religion is concerned, what the big book says, if you're really into this stuff, it says we lose all prejudice, even against organized religion. Bill Wilson was essentially sponsored by two priests, Ed Dowling, who was a Catholic priest, and Sam Shoemaker, who, you know, of Calvary Chapel in New York. That's where the steps came from. That's where it all came from, the Oxford movement, everything like that. You know, you can be pissed and moaning about that. You can be prejudiced about that. I don't care. That's the facts. That's the facts. That's what was going on. As a matter of fact, in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, look it up. It says the books that they found during the first 4 years were absolutely essential were 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the Book of James. And you can read all those things, and you'll see the steps all through them. And I'm going to tell you something, because this is going to come into, believe it or not, 8 and 9. What those steps are about, what you know what 1 Corinthians 13 is about? You know what it's about? It's called the love chapter. It says, that's the chapter, many of you guys have heard the quote, it says, but the greatest of these. It says, you could have all the knowledge in the world. You can do all the works in the world. You can do all the sacrifices in the world. You can do all the prophecy in the world. You can be the greatest preacher in the world. But without love, you have nothing. It talks about faith, hope, and charity. It says the most important thing above these, love is the most important thing. As a matter of fact, in the Bible, one of the things that was said, it says, if you want to really know who my followers are, they're the ones that love the brothers. It's all about love. Love covers a whole lot of sins. It's all about love. It's all about loving other people. The personality of the man, where it says this is the personality that separates the men from the boys, the difference between an alcoholic person who's in active alcoholism or even in a dry drunk, the difference between that person and the way somebody looks like who is self-centered and somebody who looks like is God-centered is different between somebody who only thinks about themselves and somebody who only is always thinking about other people. It's the difference. You don't want to know what it is, what the whole point is? The whole point is when you grow in the image and likeness of your creator, the creator they talk about in this book, is a person who cares and loves and serves other people. That's why it says in the book later on when it talks about the 12, it says you've got to play the Good Samaritan every day. A helpful act once in a while isn't enough. The Good Samaritan is the guy who sees the guy on the road, okay, destitute, and he goes over and he bandages his wounds and he helps him. You got to be that anyway, every day. It's all about turning from a person who's going to AA meetings to take, which is okay in the beginning, maybe the first 10 or 15 years. You know, I don't know. But somehow you end up, if you develop this personality, this psychic change, you end up going to meetings not so much to take but to give. You end up going to meetings because you want to be there to see whether there's anybody there who needs help. Because you care about what happens. Can you imagine that? Actually caring about what happens to, caring about what happens to other people. It's all about loving other people, serving other people. But really? By the way, are the traditions here anywhere? No, you don't have the traditions hanging here? You know who the leaders are in AA? Anybody know who the leaders are in AA? You know there are leaders in AA. You didn't know that? Our leaders are but trusted servants. You never heard that? That's in the traditions. You can always tell the leaders. They serve. They're serving other people. They're out there trying to help other people, trying to serve other people, thinking about other people, dealing with other people. It's all about becoming sponsors and mentors and disciplers and things like that. That's what it's all about. What's the eighth and ninth step all about? I know you get something out of it because it helps you grow in the image of light. It helps you. It's a humbling experience. But what it's all about if it's not trying to help and serve and repair the damage you did to other people? This whole thing is about becoming a servant. This whole thing is about giving out love to become a loving person. So I get this deal, I come into this, so how do you keep that, this is what Bill Wilson said in the book Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. This is how important this service and this love thing is, and this how important the connection with God is. It says right here in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, it would be hard to estimate, this is Bill Dodson, it would be hard to estimate how much Bill, this is Bill Dodson, and Bill, anybody ever heard of the guy named Bill Wilson? Yeah, you've heard of Bill Wilson, you know? He's a pretty heavy-duty guy around here. Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, those guys. You know, Bob's the guy who says if you're an atheist, an agnostic, or of any other form of self, of any other form of, what is it? I want to use the exact words. He says it in his thing. This is the last thing he says. If you think you are, don't get mad at me. This is our co-founder. You know, this is Bob Smith, Dr. Bob Smith. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride, I mean, you actually think you know shit. You think you know shit. You're a know-it-all. You think you're smarter than these guys. You think you're smarter than God. You think you're smarter than... You think you're cool, hip, slick, and cool. You think you know better. If you think you are an, if you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, I'll tell you what, when I was down on my knees saying, God, help me, I graduated with departmental honors in mathematics. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. I graduated law school. Okay, I have degrees on the wall that show me I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. I thought I knew more than anybody else. I was the smartest son of a bitch on the block. You know what I mean? You weren't going to believe me. You weren't gonna, unless you were a lawyer or a PhD, you weren't going to tell me anything, and even then I was going to argue with you. You know, believe me. Trust me. When I was down on my knees, you know, when I thought my life was over, you know, I wasn't, you know, whatever educational background I had, whatever crap I thought I had going for me, I had nothing. I was sitting there, I asked a used car salesman who didn't even graduate the sixth grade. I said, will you help me? I can't stop drinking. I didn't ask him whether he had a PhD or anything like that. You know what I mean? Okay, if you think you aren't, sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or of any other form of intellectual pride, which keeps you from accepting what is in this book. What's in this book? There is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. I feel sorry for you. I feel sorry for you. It says your heavenly Father will never let you down. That's Bob Smith. You know, I hear guys say, man, if I could only get a great sponsor, I'd be... That's what people say. Say, you know what I need? I need to get rid of my sponsor. My sponsor isn't good. I need to get another sponsor. I really need a really good sponsor. You mean like co-founders like Bob Smith and Bill Wilson? So, yeah, if I could only get... Like, man, if I could have Bob Smith or Dr. Bob or Bill Wilson... No, you wouldn't. These guys would start on you. You would be freaking out. They get you down on your knees... That's what they did. You couldn't go to a meeting unless you got down on your knees and gave your life to God. This is what Bill Wilson said. This is Bill Wilson. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that the others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, or something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. Something I hadn't got. I used to go to these meetings all the time. And I was still, I was sober, and I don't want to say it was all bad, but it was there were some good times, and the rest it was pockmarked by a whole lot of problems and situations and crises. And it seems it wasn't during early sobriety, the first 10 years. It seems like I was always going through some sort of drama. There was always some sort of drama going on, some sort of novella, some sort of something going on. I mean, I can't remember meetings I didn't go through where I didn't have issues, where I didn't have something going on. It had to do with money or my wife or my kids or my boss. There was always something going on for 10, 15 years, okay? And every once – and you want to know something? I didn't feel that odd. I knew there were, I didn't feel that odd because if it wasn't me having something going on, it was my buddy Fred having something. Everybody had something going on. Every meeting I went to, there was somebody with an issue or something going on. And people saying, yeah, I got the same thing and stuff like that. It was just problems, problems, problems. When is this ever going to stop? You know, I'd go up to a guy, I'd have 10 years at the bar, and he'd have like 2 days. And I'd say to him, you know, I'd say, listen, buddy, you don't drink. And you go to meetings, and I can't explain to you, it's all going to be okay. And he says, really? He says, I'm telling you, you don't drink, and you go to meetings, and you get a sponsor, and you keep on doing what you're doing, it's all going to be okay. And I believed it. And then he'd walk away, and I'd get in my car, and I'd say, man, when's it going to be okay for you? You're a fucking basket case, you know? You're a nut job, you know? When are you going to stop screwing up? When are you going to stop spending money you don't have? When are you going to stop getting yourself in a jam? I mean, this thing was high. I mean, 10, 15 years sober. I'm saying, when are you going to get this rocketed in the fourth dimension, experience much of heaven, you know, lose fear of people and of economic insecurity? When is that going to happen to you? And every once in a while, and I'm telling you, it's few and far between, I'd go to a meeting. We're lucky down here in South Florida, we have all these step meetings and step deal. Where I'd go to the meeting, there'd be some guy with 30, 40 years, or I'd run into these people. Man, it was, they're as rare as hen's teeth. I'm telling you that there was something else. They had something else going for them. They were playing it. I mean, I was sober and they were sober. I was going to meetings. They were going to meetings, but they were at a different deal. I never saw them complain. I never saw them in what appeared to be worried about stuff. I never saw them. They were always in the same mode, and they always seemed to have this peace about them where they were confident in their own skin. They were always trying to help other people. You know, and at first, when I first saw them, I thought, well, all these guys are probably extremely wealthy. They probably get all the sex they want, or whatever the heck I thought. I thought that it's because they had all, and I later learned that some of these guys that seemed so peaceful, one of them had terminal cancer. Another one I learned had no money at all, you know, had no money at all. And people used to come from miles around, doctors, to ask him questions and ask his advice because he was so wise. He had no money. I used to think these guys must be rich, or they must have this, or they must have that, because you had to have that stuff in order to be okay. And these guys were happy, and they were joyous, and they were helping people, and they had all sorts of problems. But to them, it wasn't even a problem. They were wearing life like a loose garment. The Apostle Paul calls it, it's the secret. I've learned to be content in all things. Rich or poor, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me. My bank account can be high. I'm this person. It's low. I'm the same person. Who I am and what I am and how I feel does not depend upon the circumstances of my life. Having a job or not having a job, being in love, it doesn't matter, because that's not where my peace comes from. And so I would go to those meetings, and I knew by watching these people, I knew there was something more than mere physical sobriety. I knew that there were people in this program. Now, of course, one of the things that I sort of suspected, and I found out later on was true. I'm an alcoholic. You know, if you're an alcoholic like me, I'll tell you one thing about alcoholics. We want to get well like that. I mean, you know, I'll tell you why I drank. You know why I drank? Because I would go whack, and I was okay. That's how booze works. Booze works like this. Whack, whack, I'm fine. Whack, whack, I don't give a shit, you know? Whack, whack, let them fire me. Screw them. Whack, whack, who gives a crap what she thinks, you know? Whack, booze works. Drugs work. Marijuana works. All that stuff works, you know? The other stuff works a little bit slow, but it still works okay. Good-looking gal looks okay. Sex works, you know? The car works. Buy a blouse works, you know? Go out and buy something that I can't afford, you know, spend money on myself, do stuff like that. It works pretty quick. AA, you know, 15 years and 2,000 meetings, you know what I mean? To get the same effect, you know? I mean, I don't know about you, but I ain't in for that shit, you know? I ain't down for that, okay? I want, if you're an alcoholic, you want, it's your feelings. All you care about is you. Hey, look, when you're selfish and you're self-centered and you're childish, you want what you want when you want it right now. The idea of delayed gratification, that don't worry, you work this thing, you're going to go through turmoil, you're going to go through all sorts of crap, but in the end, after you go through the AA boot camp, which is going to last 5 or 10 years, you're going to be a man, does not appeal to me. I'm sorry, it doesn't appeal to me. I want the shorter course. I want the faster course. But you know what the point is? I knew, like everybody who goes to meetings, I knew, just like this guy knew, I knew there was something more. I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. And that's what this guy says. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said, "Henrietta," is what Bill Wilson said, "the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people." I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God, they don't say higher power, you know, the Frosty the Snowman, they say he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. So how do you keep that humility in a fellowship that has developed into a fellowship that people feel funny about talking about God because they feel that people are not going to like them? That has developed into a fellowship of psychobabble. Now, I'm not putting down AA. I mean, I love AA, and I'm not saying it's all like this, but sometimes I go to meetings, I listen to people, and they'll come up to me and says, man, I've never heard anybody talk like you. If I talked like you, they'd beat the crap out of me at meetings. They don't even like to hear the word God. They don't like to hear about it. I'm spiritual, not religious. Don't say anything about the Bible. I mean, they'll, you know, I mean, you know, I think newcomers in here get the feeling that if they mention the word God, they're going to be sliced and diced and hurt and killed. And where does that come from? It didn't come from these guys. That's all they were talking about because you want to know something? When you're dealing with a fellowship, this ain't exactly Well People's Anonymous, of people that generally really don't want to do this thing and want to try to figure out, because, you know, we are selfish, self-centered, and self-deluded. And when you're dealing with a lot of self-deluded people that now have their toys back and want to do the things they want to do and play the games they want to play, you understand what I'm saying? Don't want to make the sacrifice they got to make. What you do is you try to do AA light. Read, there's an essay called, I'll be happy to send it to you, called The Stronger Cup of Tea. They try to do AA light. And when you finally figure out that you don't have to do all this God stuff, you don't have to do the stuff the old-timers are doing, and you can still stay physically sober for 10 or 15 years, you don't like to hear people like me or other people talking about how focused you have to be in God, even though all the steps in the book says that's what the whole thing is about. So what do I have to do? I have to do everything. I have to do the whole thing. I have to do the eighth step. I got to make those amends. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, which was one of the basic books, they said were absolutely necessary. One of the things they said in the sermon, it says, you want to get close to God, you leave your sacrifice at the altar. If you have something against your brother, you take care of your brother. You make that straight, and then you come back to me. Don't come to me before you take care of your brother. You know what I mean? That's not my rule. That's his rule. Who's he? He's the guy they were talking about in Sermon on the Mount. Who's that guy? What book is that? That's the book that they said were absolutely. That's the book that the old timers said were absolutely essential. When you hear rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our step. The thing they thoroughly did was they read that book. That's what they did. Now you don't have to. I'm not asking you to like that. As a matter of fact, you can hate that. I don't care. You can do it. You cannot do it. But it doesn't stop me from talking about it. One of the things I got to do. And how do I keep the same attitude I have about God and how important He is and how unimportant I am in my life? How do I keep that same attitude I had when I was down on my knees in January and December saying, God help? How do I keep that attitude? By coming in here and professing out loud that He's the deal, that God's the deal. Let me tell you something. You are what you talk about. I'm going to tell you this right now. You are what you talk about. If you want to talk about the cars, you want to talk about the girls, you want to talk about the guys, you want to talk about the romance, you want to talk about the sex, you want to talk about the problems, you want to talk about all that sort of stuff, that's what you are. You want to tell everybody in the world that you're screwed up. You want to tell everybody in the world that you're bipolar. You want to tell everybody in the world that you got all sorts of problems and you're depressive. You want to tell everybody in the world that you're feeling like shit. You want to tell everybody in the world that things are horrible. You want to tell everybody in the world that, you know, you're not going to know about the money. You want to tell everybody about the world about the problems. That's exactly who you will be, because you want to some. You believe every word that comes out of your mouth. And you will never be okay. You know why? Because you're listening to you. You're listening to you. You want to start changing and telling people that God's working in your life. You want to start saying things like Henrietta, the Lord's been so wonderful to me. He's been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease so that I can sit here and I have a choice whether to drink or not drink. And that's such a wonderful thing. This has been lifted for me that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. You want to start doing that, you're going to start getting the same thing out of this that Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob got out of this. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, I know you worry about what the people in A are going to think about you if you talk like I talk. I get it. I understand. I got like 34 years. They ain't going to fire me. You know, by the way, I learned it 25 years. Sober, 25 years sober, I realized that if I talk like this, they can't tell me you can't come back to AA. Nobody's going to fire you. Nobody's going to come down from New York and say, I hear you're quoting shit from the... Nobody's going to come down from New York, I hear you're quoting shit from the big book and talking about God, you can't come back to AA. That ain't going to happen. You know what I mean? Don't say anything about the Bible, you can't come back. Believe me, that'll never happen. You will never hear AA New York say, if anybody talks about the Bible, they're barred from AA. Because if everybody who read the Bible was barred from AA, the whole thing would fall apart. Because they're the only people that are keeping this son of a gun thing together. That's the cement that's keeping this whole thing together, the ones that are really focused. You know what I mean? That allows all the crazy people to jump around and do all sorts of stuff because there are people here that are actually solid. You understand what I'm saying? And you want something just like they can't fire me or tell me I can't go to AA. You know, they can't fire you even though you have 6 months. You may say some stupid stuff, you know, but maybe they can't fire you. You know, they could hurt your feelings because your feelings are hurtable, you know? Your feelings are hurtable. You know, when you're new, you got hurtable feelings, you know? So, and I understand that. I'm not saying you should go out and do this stuff, you know? Don't do what I do. I'm a professional, you know? Don't do this at home, okay? But I'm trying to get a point across that it is palpable in Alcoholics Anonymous that a lot of the stuff that they focus on in the big book that they have you do in order to keep you humble and focused on God and God-centered, if you actually said it out loud with feelings at AA meeting, a lot of people wouldn't like it. And they talk about it in the big book. They say, once we start talking about God, doesn't it say in chapter of the Gnostics, if a mere code of moral, we do everything to avoid God, good orderly direction. In the big book, it says, if a mere code, a moral code, or a better philosophy of life would have solved our problems, we'd be sober a long time ago, but it didn't solve our problems. Lack of power was our deliverer, so we had to talk about God. And even though it says a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life won't solve our problems, we make up this thing called good orderly direction, G-O-D, which is just a mere code, a moral philosophy of life. You understand what I'm saying? But we say, that'll be like God, so we won't have to talk about God. It is amazing the length alcoholics will do so they can avoid talking about a deity or a real serious higher power. And as long as you realize that that's what's going on in the fellowship, I mean, that's the fellowship. We have a wide funnel with millions and millions of people. And most of the people probably in AA have less, most of the people, probably 90% have less than 10 years. You understand what I'm saying? You know, when I came in, you know, it seemed to me like for every 10 people, there was one guy with 30 years or 20 years or something, you know, to keep, you know. And now it's like maybe for every guy with 30 years, there's like 100 or 200 people or something like that. It's mostly a younger fellowship because, you know, treatment centers are pumping this thing in and everything like that, which is all good and well, but understand, you can stay sober based upon the big book and what's in here and the 12 and 12 and Dr. Bob and the good old timers, or you can stay sober based upon the, quote, wisdom of the rooms. And there's a difference. And sometimes, the truth of the matter is, sometimes the rooms can be very, very wise and say a lot of good things. And sometimes they can say things that are not necessarily from the big book. They sort of water down the big book, but they sound good and you like them because it makes you feel better because you can do that better than you can do what they're talking about in here. Does anybody understand what I'm saying? Do you get it? Okay, so next week we'll talk about something else. I don't know. We'll talk about 10th step or something. Thank you.
Please help me thank Russell one more time. And now we're going to have our Plan B, Recovered Alcoholic Secretary Ronnie, do our secretary report. Let's see, where do I start? Oh, there it is. Yeah, sorry. All right.
Hi, my name is Ronnie, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. Ask a member to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. And I've asked Max to come and read that.
My name is Max. I'm an alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
let's see, 1940-style Big Book sponsorship, from the foreword to the second edition Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. what is this? Can I ask for a show of hand of recovered alcoholics? Cool. And anyone in need of a sponsor, please raise your hand. And this is the, we're going to have the people raise their hands because last month we weren't able to for the December anniversaries. Anybody celebrating a December anniversary? Jesus. All right. Well, cool. Let's see. Please join us for Monday nights for our Big Book study meeting. Fellowship is at 6:30 and the Big Book study starts at 7:15. If you should require a Big Book of your own, we have large print editions for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 8:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. And just to let you guys know, we're going to have Keith N. from the Wednesday night study group starting after Russell is done. And looks like we'll see you next week. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Ronnie. And if you want to catch up with any of the podcasts from this meeting for the entire time we've had it, they're on alcoholicsandgod.org, including tonight. Again, I'd like to invite everybody here to our Big Book study on Monday nights in the other room. We have an hour of fellowship starting at 6:15, and the meeting is at 7:15. It's where we get really into the book and the mechanics of it and try to become better sponsors, and it's really really a blast. It's really cool. You should check it out. Russell, thanks again for speaking for us. All right. Thank you all for coming. We have a great way of closing. We do the prayer sitting down. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. See you next week.
Thirsty, body's aching. I am desperately in need of restoration. Yeah, and I am ready for you to take me higher. Yeah, the only thing that I can do is keep on praying, 'cause on my own I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees, stay back on my feet again. Load is heavy, too much to carry. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all. In the end.
There's a girl in the corner with tear stains on her eye. From the places she's wandered and the shame she can't hide, she says, how did I get here? I'm not who I once was, and I'm crippled by the fear that I've fallen too far to love. But don't you know who you are, what has been done for you? Don't you know who you are? You are more than the choice that you've made. You are more than the sum of your past mistakes. You are more than the problems you create. You've been remade. Well, she tries to believe it, that she's been given new life. But she can't shake the feeling, well, that it's not true tonight. She knows all the answers, and she's rehearsed all the lines. And so she'll try to do better, but then she's too weak to try. But don't you know who you are? Mistakes, you are more than the problems you create. You've been remade. You are more than the